Hi, this is Susan L. Shulman, the author of Backstage Pass to Broadway, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom! Oh, shalom, goddammit! I am so thrilled to be here with someone who has been next to stars, helping stars in the theater world get them perfectly and precisely placed where they ought to be. Oh, I love the onomatopoeia there. No, wait, that was alliteration. Well, whatever, look it up. Anywho, she has written a book. Her name is Susan L. What does the L stand for,
buddy? Linda.
Susan Linda Shulman. And you did this. Is there another Susan Shulman who's a press agent?
No, but there are three Susan Shulmans in the theater. There's me, who's a press agent.
Uh-huh.
There is Susan H. Shulman, who is a director.
Right.
And there is Susan F. Shulman, who is a literary agent. And we're all about the same age. We've all been in the business for 20, 30, 40 years. We've all known each other forever. And that's why we all use our middle initials.
Makes absolute sense. So Susan Linda. Shulman. Yes. So if they're all at these different names, were you at one point going to be an actress? I know you were in high school.
I was in high school. I was in college. I acted in many things over the years. But I think early on I knew I wasn't tough enough. I think I had a little bit of talent, but I didn't think I had a huge amount of talent.
A little brains,
a little talent. Exactly, but not quite as much as Gwen Verdon. And so I think early on I realized I wasn't tough enough, and that I was getting enough, you know, rejection in daily life that I didn't have to audition for it. And so I think early on I knew that I wanted to be in the theater, but I didn't know how to be in the theater because there wasn't an obvious way in for me. I didn't know anybody in the theater. My family didn't know anybody in the theater. I had no connections in the theater. But I went to college, and I was a theater major, and I got a master's degree in theater. And I just eventually found my way in as a press agent, which was something I was ideally suited for, and
that
turns
was
out I was good for.
A fluky story, like you knew someone who had a job opening, and I'm trying to remember from the book.
Well, what happened was I was, when I was in college, by accident, I participated in a publicity stunt. I didn't actually know it was a publicity stunt. It was for a show called Marathon 33 that was produced by the Actors Studio. It was Julie Harris and a lot of other wonderful actors. And I had seen it, and I liked it, and I was at the box office buying a standing room ticket to see it again. And I was chatting with the box office guy, who was nice, and I said, how's it going? And I said, I love the show. And he said, well, it's kind of struggling. And I said, oh, is there anything I can do to help? And he said, well, you should talk to Iggy Wolfington. And if you're a theater person, you would know that Iggy Wolfington was the guy in The Music Man who sang Shapoopy Robert Preston. So I knew who Iggy Wolfington was. And so I went to see Iggy Wolfington. And he said, oh, we're going to have this parade, and we're going to give out flyers, and, you know, come be part of it. And so when I was in college, without really understanding what I was doing, I actually was part of a publicity stunt. And I think I always had the gene. I just didn't know that I had the gene.
But it's funny that you mentioned you weren't, quote-unquote, tough enough to be an actress.
Mm-hmm.
Did you even have any idea how tough you'd have to be a press agent?
Not a clue. It's a whole different kind of... It's not even toughness. I think it's perseverance. And you see there's a sign on my desk that says, never, never quit. And I think it's that kind of toughness is that... I suggest something to you and you say no, well then I have to figure out who else might be interested, or maybe there's something else that you might be interested in. And so there's a creative side to it, but it's also a stick-to-itiveness and a perseverance that you need.
A few weeks ago I was interviewing Brian Gary, who is the grandson, of course, of Eddie Cantor, Eddie Cantor.
Yes.
So, but Cantor's thing was, if you can't get in the front door, go through the back. And
exactly.
This was not a gay thing.
That's true of publicity too. My job is to figure out what I have to sell and then who might be interested in it. And it's putting those two together. And so it may not be the obvious choice. It may be maybe I'll find out that an actor has some skill. Maybe he or she knits, or she does yoga, or she does I don't know what. And then it's my job to figure out who might be interested in that.
Hmm.
And put those two elements together.
hot young actresses doing yoga. Everybody's interested in that.
That's probably true.
By the way,
that's probably true.
The thing that people should be interested in, I neglected to mention this so far, is I am interviewing Susan Linda Schulman because she has written a book.
That's
and the book
right.
is called Backstage Pass to Broadway, True Tales from a Theatrical Press Agent. It's from Heliotrope Books. Which you can order on Amazon and all the usual.
Absolutely.
And it's Kindleable and all that.
Yes, it's got all that ebooks and paperbacks. And you can also go to my website, which is very cleverly titled www.backstagepasstobroadway.com. How clever is that? And you can also order the book through there.
Any way you want to read it. And it is totally a gripping, enjoyable, fun read. Let's talk, first of all, since we were talking about stunts and publicity things. There are times when you think something will work, something ought to work. One of the two times that you mentioned, this would make sense to me, I guess, if it were a famous star. But there was someone who was going to go from regular face to be made up as the camera. What happened?
I handled a play called Go Fly a Kite. And it was a play in which a man impersonated, Benjamin Franklin.
All right.
Benjamin Franklin. It's called Go Fly Kite. Get it? Benjamin Franklin, electricity, go fly kite.
Okay.
So this actor did this very, quite impressive transformation with makeup from himself into Ben Franklin. And there had been a very famous sequence of photos taken of Hal Holbrook when he was playing Mark Twain in Mark Twain Tonight. And there was a very famous sequence of him doing this transformation with makeup. And so we decided that we would do one with this actor who was going to be transformed into Benjamin Franklin, which sounded like a really good idea at the time. And so we set this up at Sardi's, which is a theatrical restaurant that everybody's heard of. And we got an old-fashioned makeup table with an old-fashioned mirror so that there was a visual setup. And I tipped the press, and he got all set up with all his makeup pens and wigs and eyebrows and whatever else he had.
Bras and panties, yes.
Whatever, and he was all set and ready to go. Unfortunately, no press came. And so I was very busy scurrying around calling the assignment editors to see if maybe they were caught in traffic or, you know, if it was somehow delayed or there was a fire someplace. And the bottom line was that nobody cared. There was nobody that was interested in this, what we thought was going to be just a really cute stunt. And the actor who was lovely and was very, very, you know, diligent, finally said to me, well, don't you think I should start my makeup? Because, you know, it takes an hour. And, you know, he hadn't quite grasped that if you do a publicity stunt and no press come, you got nothing. And so we kind of very sweetly and tactfully told him that he could, you know, probably pack up his pens and grease paint and go home.
What was the mistake there then? I mean,
I think he just wasn't he wasn't well enough known to make it interesting.
Like, for example,
it sounded good on paper, but it didn't actually.
They just did a piece on CBS this morning that Val Kilmer is portraying Mark Twain. He's doing it, probably wants to bring that to Broadway at some point. Would you, if it were Val Kilmer, make the same decision?
Yes, because he's a big enough name that they probably would come out of curiosity to see what he was going to look like.
Okay.
You know, so yes, that probably would have worked better.
So sometimes the name is the name.
A star is a star is a star, and there's no getting around that. There's, you know, that helps a lot.
Now another stunt that you pulled, as it were, this is really cool, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but I can totally tell why this did not work, was you had a play that involved boxing and fisticuffs and all that.
Yes, it was called The Last of the Knucklemen, and it was directed by Pete Masterson, who was the force behind Bessemer Whorehouse in Texas. And this was a play in which, I can't actually remember the plot anymore, but there was a lot of very realistic fighting in the play, people boxing and beating the hell out of each other. And so the great minds came up with the idea of doing a stunt where we would create a boxing ring alongside the Tix booth in Times Square where people line up to buy theater tickets. And we thought, oh, if we do this stunt there, people that are waiting to buy tickets will be so intrigued by this clever stunt that we're going to do that when they get to the window, they'll say, I'd like tickets for the Last of the Knucklemen. That was the theory.
Right.
So we got four pretty young girls to stand in for the four posts at the corners of the boxing ring. And okay. we had a rope around them, so there was a square. And we had these young actors who, by the way, included Dennis Quaid, who was then quite unknown, but, you know, young, hunky, attractive actor. And these three or four young, very attractive actors got into the boxing ring and proceeded to basically beat the hell out of each other with much grunting and cheering and rolling around the ground. And, of course, the rest of us walking up and down the Tix line, shilling for the show and handing out flyers and doing our best to beat the drums. What we hadn't really factored into this was that this is New York. And people fight all the time in New York. And you see people on the street fighting, and people just kind of walk around them.
Yeah, that's one thing, and you look away.
You look away. You just kind of ignore them and hope it goes away. And so that's pretty much what they did on the Tix line. They just basically ignored us. And we just finally, I said, I think we could stop now. And we all kind of slunk away because nobody cared that these cute guys were just beating the hell out of each other.
I mean, but...
It sounded good on
paper.
You had
the ring, you had the
sounded good, but no.
Well, what's the opposite? What's a stunt that you did that worked like gangbusters?
Well, it's not one that I did, but early in my career, I worked for a gentleman named Bill Dahl. Bill Dahl was kind of the last of the old-fashioned razzle-dazzle press agents. And his client was Mike Todd.
Oh.
And Mike Todd, as I'm sure your listeners will know, was married to Elizabeth Taylor. And one of the things that Mike Todd did was he produced a film called Round the World in 80 Days, which had many, many, many big stars in it. And Bill Dahl, as they say, was the king of stunts and the king of this sort of old-style razzle-dazzle press agentry. And among other things that he did was he created a party for the opening day or opening night of Around the World in 80 Days. The highlight, in Madison Square Garden.
Oh, wow.
And the highlight of the party was Elizabeth Taylor, the most beautiful woman in the entire universe, riding into Madison Square Garden on an elephant. And if you don't think that made the front pages of every newspaper in the universe, you would be wrong.
Wow.
That's a stunt.
And did it generate...
It was on the front page of every newspaper in the world. I mean, it was Elizabeth Taylor on an elephant in Madison Square Garden.
But then could you quantify sales of the film?
It's a movie people still know about, so probably yes.
Cool.
It's probably, 50 years later or something? I don't know. I was a kid, I remember, when it came out, so it's a long time ago.
We're talking with Susan L.
Schulman.
Keep the L in there, ladies and gentlemen, and make sure you get the L to the website of BackstagePassToBroadway.com to get Susan's book about not just the stunts that she's done, but also the many, many theater people, the Broadway people that she's worked with.
Yep.
Most of the stories are sweet and nice, many of them.
Mm-hmm.
There are three people in the book who you would have to say are the villains, not just one. You've got three horrible people. One that I didn't know about was the director John Dexter, who I guess was M. Butterfly, but you were working with him on other things. And was he Miss Saigon also?
Well,
No, he wasn't. Okay.
No.
But
M. Butterfly.
Was
hard to say, yes.
But you worked with him on some earlier stuff, and he just seemed like a piece carved out of hell.
Well, actually, the play that I worked on was called The Merchant, and it was actually much later than M. Butterfly. It was it was later than that, and it was the show that it was a play by Arnold Wesker, and Arnold Wesker and John Dexter had been kind of partners in their early careers, where they had done a tremendous number of plays at the Royal Court Theatre in London with huge success, sort of kitchen sink plays they were known as. And but the production that I worked on was called The Merchant, and it was directed by John Dexter, written by Arnold Wesker, and it was starring Zero Mostel.
Wow.
And, of course, Zero Mostel was famous for Fiddler on the Roof, and Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, but this was a serious play that was Arnold Wesker's take on The Merchant of Venice, seen from the Jewish perspective. And Zero, who was, of course, Jewish, was someone who felt very strongly about his roots and about his Judaism, and he was very committed to this play. The problem was that the play, sometimes you work on a production and if something can go wrong, it does go wrong. And
right.
This was one of those. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And plus, John Dexter was a very difficult man, and he liked to pick on people. and he liked to create dissension among the cast, and he liked to play people against each other. And he did. And
I mean, was this like the West Side Story thing where Jerome Robbins would have the Sharks on one side of the Jets and keep the cast away and make them hate
it?
But this is worse because Dexter seemed like a real asshole.
Well, I can't say that he was an asshole, but I can say that he was somebody that knew who was the most vulnerable in a group, and he'd go for that person. And that's what was painful. There was a young actress in the cast named Julie Garfield, and she was John Garfield's daughter, the famous actor who had been blacklisted in his earlier years. And Julie was his daughter, and in fact, had been a family friend. John Garfield and the Mostels were friends. And so Julie had grown up knowing the Mostels, so she had some relationship with them. But for whatever reason, Dexter made her the whipping boy in the cast. And so she was always being humiliated and being picked on, and he would do it in front of the whole company. And it was awful to watch because he was, you know, he could be really quite cruel. And there was no reason for it because she hadn't been foisted on him. He had chosen her.
Right.
And that was the thing that initially I thought, well, maybe that was the reason. Maybe Mostel had said, I want this young girl in the cast. But I found out that wasn't the case at all. She had auditioned and Dexter had picked her. So there was no explaining it. But I later learned that he did this in every production. He always had a scapegoat. And in this particular show, it was poor Julie Garfield, who was a perfectly fine actress. There was nothing wrong with her. She was fine. But he knew she was vulnerable, and so he would go for the jugular. And it was awful. I mean, it was really cruel. But, I mean, whatever could go wrong did go wrong on this show. I mean, things like, there's something called the front-of-house pictures. When you go to the theater, you see big blow-ups of cast pictures. And one of the things that Dexter had done, as you say, with West Side Story, he had always... he sort of played the Jews against the Christians.
Okay, well, that I get. I mean, so I get.
But, for instance, he would call the cast on the company board when they would call rehearsals. Usually you would list character names or you would list actors' names to be called. This group would be called at 2 o'clock. This group would be called 3 o'clock for rehearsals. And in this show, it was the Jews at 2 o'clock, the Christians at 3 o'clock. So it was...
But that I get.
Well,
I
mean, but it was
within
unusual.
The context of the play.
No,
okay.
But it wasn't in the context of the play. This was in the context of actors.
Mm.
So it was different. It wasn't calling...
Well, it was actors playing Jews. It wasn't just the Jewish actors in the cast.
But the call board would say the Jews at 4 o'clock, the Christians... No,
right.
that's not normal.
Okay.
It isn't. I'm telling you, it's not.
That's how I pick my minions. But
there you go. That's a different story altogether. So anyway, so by the time we finally got out of town, which was we were going to two cities before New York. We were going to Philadelphia and then to Washington, D.C., the Kennedy Center, and then it was coming to Broadway. And by the time the show finally went to Philadelphia, the morale was pretty low, and the actors were all pretty nervous, and everybody knew that the play had to be cut.
It was 4.5 hours long.
Well, we didn't know that yet because we hadn't done it yet. But it was long. Everybody knew it was long. And people were worried that their scenes were going to get cut. It was all very tense. And by the time we got to Philadelphia, one of the things that the press agent does is design the front of house. So we pick the photos that will be blown up, and we decide which is going to be in window case, and it's all prescribed, and, you know, we arrange that. And one of the things that Dexter had done was create this visual... In the big courtroom scene, and the Jews were always on one side of the stage and the Christians were always on the other side of the stage, and that was the kind of motif of the show, and it was a very distinct thing. And when the picture got blown up for the front of the house, for the outside of the theater in Philadelphia, it got flipped. Some
negative,
some photo person flipped it by mistake. And Dexter pulled up in front of the theater and saw that the Jews were on the wrong side of the stage and went nuts. And he went nuts at me because I was the person who was in charge. And, I mean, obviously it got fixed instantly.
Right, well.
But whatever could go wrong went wrong. So the show did its first preview in Philadelphia. It was over 4 hours long. They'd never had a run-through because they'd never had the time to have a full run-through. So it was really like the dress rehearsal.
Boy.
It was a very big, complicated show with big sets and a lot of cast. It was a big show. And they did one over 4 hour performance, and which I saw, and you thought, wow, this could be good. It has to be cut, but this is good because it can't be 4 hours long.
Right,
obviously,
right.
It's called golden time in the theater. You can't
Angels in Venice.
There's a lot of people getting paid overtime on a 4 hour show, And so we knew it had to be cut. But the next day, right before the matinee, Z got sick and he was taken to the hospital.
Z meaning Zero Mustel.
Meaning Zero Mustel. And who was a little bit of a tyrant himself. And went into the hospital and subsequently died. So that was, you know, on one hand, it was this terrible tragedy, of course. But on the other hand, everything that could have gone wrong had gone wrong already. So I wasn't all that surprised when he died. I just thought, well, it's we've been waiting for the other shoe to drop, and now it has. And so what happened was John Dexter went to the Schuberts, who were the lead producers, and said, what are you going to do? If you're going to move forward, you have to do it right away because I have other things to do. He was the head of the artistic director of the Metropolitan Opera at the time, so he had operas to direct. So he said, this is the window of opportunity. If you're going to go forward, you have to go forward immediately. But I have, and he listed all of these major, major actors he claimed to have in his back pocket, starting with Laurence Olivier and Danny Kaye and many other. I think Peter O'Toole was mentioned. There were a lot of really impressive names because this character needed to be played by somebody larger than life, as Zero Mustel was. I mean, he was that kind of a big actor.
If I had been my age at that time, it would have been me, of course.
There you go. So since you weren't available and Z was dead, we had to find somebody else.
Right.
And so Dexter said, we have to go forward, and I've got all these people in my back pocket. And the Schuberts said, okay. But it turned out he didn't have anybody in his back pocket. And he wound up promoting Z's understudy, who was a perfectly lovely, very capable character actor named Joseph Leon, who no one had ever heard of. And so poor Joe Leon was forced into this larger-than-life character, and he really never had a prayer, because Dexter made him imitate everything that Z had done.
Oh.
He made him wear Z's costumes. In his yarmulke, it said, you know, Zero Mustel. He was never allowed to make it his own. And so eventually the show did come to New York. It played at the Kennedy. No, it didn't play. Yes, it did play at the Kennedy Center. We canceled Philadelphia because that was out of the question. And it did play in the Kennedy Center, and then it sort of limped into New York with poor Joe Leon in the leading role. Oh, Sam Levine, who had been the second lead in the play, was with Z at the hospital when he died, and so he left the show because he was so upset that his friend, you know, he couldn't continue with the play. And so everything about it changed, and it came to New York, and it lasted about a week.
Well,
but the bottom line to the whole thing was something really weird that happened. As I say, we were always sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop, and when Z died, we sort of felt that was the other shoe. But the final night of the show, at the final curtain call, the cast came out for their bows, and as they were taking their final bow, in every theater on Broadway, there is something called the fire curtain, this big, heavy asbestos curtain that is up in the flies, and it's there in case there's a fire. It's brought down so that the stage is sealed off from the house. So I guess that means the actors burn up or the theater, I don't know, but there's an asbestos fire curtain, and you never see it except in an emergency. So it's up there someplace. And that night, at the end of the curtain calls, just as the actors were taking their final call, somehow the fire curtain came loose and started to come down, crashing down onto the stage. And out of the corner of their eye, the actors saw it, and they pulled everybody back to safety, and nobody was hurt.
Oddly enough, they pushed John Dexter in front of
them. They would have if they could have, I'm sure. But it was one of those things that was, I mean, I've never heard of this happening. Nobody's ever heard of this happening. No one knows how it happened. No one knows why it happened. But it did happen. And aside from the fact that everybody was a little shaken up by this because it could have been horrible, it could have been catastrophic, Roberta Maxwell, who was in the company, who played...
Portia,
thank you, said... It was Zero getting the last laugh.
Wow. What I don't understand is, how does John Dexter then go on to direct M. Butterfly and other things?
He is brilliant. He's a very smart guy. He's a very prolific guy. And he is a very strong personality. And I guess he was able to convince people. You're right. M. Butterfly was after that. You're absolutely right. I stand corrected. But he was somebody that was had been a huge, huge talent, but he was very difficult. And in fact, in his obit, the New York Times quoted I think it was his a costume designer, as saying something to that effect, that he was brilliant, but he was very, very, very abrasive and very difficult to work with.
Now, I wonder what the New York Times obituary will be for Leslie Ann Warren, who, I mean, fairly well-known movie actress, not with all due respect, well, no, there's no respect to her in this book, there shouldn't be, but not a star, and yet she was in a, and I remember this because Dave, my good friend Dave, who hosts this radio program.
I know Dave, yes.
Was that kind of a jerk too, but I get along with him. And something of a stud, by the way. Anywho, he was covering this for when he was working at Playbill, we should pardon the expression, and when Dream was coming out, and he was a critic and was writing about it, yep. And then all this stuff would be coming out in the New York Post about what was really going on backstage at this simple little dance musical, seemingly nice musical called Dream, starring Leslie Ann Warren.
Yep.
Tell us about this woman.
Well, here's the thing. When you work in the theater, you work with some really wonderful, talented people, and sometimes you work with people that kind of can't get out of their own way. And there are certain actors that tend to shoot themselves in the foot. And this was an example of somebody with talent. I mean, Leslie Ann Warren's a beautiful woman. She's talented. She can sing. She can dance. She can act. She's talented. But she kind of sabotages herself a little bit. And this was an example of a show that was really created. It wasn't created for her, but it was built around her abilities. But she made choices that tended to, in a funny way, sabotage herself. And it was really fascinating because, you know, I'm somebody that tries to protect people and tries to make it easy for them and not set them up for failure in any way. I want to protect them. I feel actors are very brave people, and I respect actors. I love actors. So, for instance, she presented a bio that was so over the top and so self-aggrandizing. Is that the word?
Yes.
Thank you. And I went to her and I said, you know, critics know that the actors provide the bios for the Playbill. And I fear that, you know, this bio sets you up. You know, it's you saying, for all practical purposes, this is you saying you're the greatest thing ever. And, you know, maybe would you like me to, you know, rethink it for you, or would you like
Tear
to
it
edit
down a little,
or
yeah.
edit it or whatever? And she said, that's the bio. And so, and was actually very annoyed with me. And in fact, I was trying to protect her.
Right.
I was trying to help her. But she didn't get that. And so this very kind of over-the-top bio, which said, you know, she's the greatest thing to ever set foot on a stage or screen or whatever, ran, and I'm, without a doubt, people rolled their eyes and kind of laughed, and it was unnecessary, you know what I mean?
Right.
It was the sort of thing that she didn't get that I was, in fact, trying to help her.
Yeah, the most important actors in the world, the Broadway actors, are like Broadway credits, off-Broadway
exactly.
credits, TV,
well,
film,
and even if
and
you
love
don't,
to my wife.
And if you don't, even if you don't want it to be that kind of list bio, which a lot of people do now, even if you want it to be more personal or whatever, there are ways to do it. And you can still get all your credits, and you can still get all your awards, and you can still get all the accolades, but there's a way to do it that is a little more self-effacing than that.
Like,
and this was a case.
For example,
yeah.
Leslie Ann Warren may seem like a horrible bitch, but
didn't,
dot, dot, dot.
I didn't say that. The rabbi said that, not me.
It's through every sentence
no,
of this
you never,
chapter in the
you
book.
You don't. There's not a word like that in my book.
No, but you can read between.
That's your choice, but I don't want to get sued either.
In the book, you do not call her
no, I don't.
Names or John Dexter. Or
no,
we'll
I
talk
don't.
About who's the other. Oh, well, David
Merrick.
Merrick.
Well,
yeah.
But here's the thing: the things that I write about in this book, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but these are all things that happened in public. For instance, one day I got a call from Michael Riedel, who's the theater writer for the New York Post, who knows everything. He has a mole in every company, and he called me up one day and he said, during Dream, and he said, "I hear Leslie Ann Warren just threw a chair at the producer." And I said, "Oh, Michael, come on! What is this? A slow news day or something? What are you crazy? Don't be silly." He said, "I hear Leslie Ann Warren threw a chair at the producer." So I hang up and I call around, and it turns out that Leslie Ann Warren threw a chair at the producer, but she did it in front of 20 people.
Which makes it public, per se.
Well, it's public, but it's also, it's very hard to deny something that happens in front of 20 people. And clearly one of those 20 people picked up the phone and called Michael Riedel. It
right.
wasn't me.
I should call Equity, too, but yeah. Okay,
that's
right.
another. No, Equity doesn't protect producers. They only protect actors. So this was an instance of something that happened. This didn't happen in a private room, which
right.
is me and Leslie and Warren. These are things that happened in public. And those are the things that I write about, because the book is about seeing celebrity through my eyes, through the eyes of a press agent. And so these are things that happened that were public knowledge. And so I'm not telling tales about things that happened in private. I'm talking about things that happened in front of
John Dexter flipped at you for the flipped photograph,
mm-hmm.
were people watching?
You betcha.
Oh, boy.
The whole cast was there.
Right. So it's not just a grudge thing of settling scores on someone of your own.
No.
Oh, so tell us something that's not in the book. It can be someone dead.
Someone dead? A lot of people in the book are dead.
Right, so who would be someone,
I'm not going there. Not going
right.
there.
Nope. Okay.
Not going
right.
there.
Okay.
No. Nope. But you have to also remember that there are wonderful stories about people behaving wonderfully. And I mean, for instance, I talk in the book about Mary Martin, who was I was a lifelong fan of hers, and it went from being a kid outside a stage door waiting for her autograph, or not even wanting her autograph, just wanted to tell her she was wonderful, to eventually becoming two professionals working in the theater. And she was enormously kind and considerate of me. And I was a kid. I mean, I was 13 years old when I first met her outside the Sound of Music. And I saw the Sound of Music, and I loved it, and I wrote her a note. And she answered. And so I wrote her another note. And I said, I'm seeing it again. Could I come and see you? And she said, yes. And that's how it started. She left my name at a stage door.
I mean, people think that in this age of TMZ, people just want the bad stuff.
That's right.
Well, I think people really also want to hear the nice things.
Mm-hmm.
And probably 80% mm-hmm. is nice.
Well, it because these are people that I worked with. This is my story. I mean, this is my career. My career is not over, but these are interesting people that I've worked with over the years. So they're not all. It's not all about stars. It's not all about Broadway stars. It's about lots of different people. But it's things that I thought might be interesting or amusing or fun for people to know. My whole career, something would happen, and I'd tell my friends, and they would say, "I hope you're writing this stuff down." And I didn't, actually. I didn't. There's only one story in the book that I ever wrote down, and that was the story about Abbie Hoffman, the famous fugitive.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And it was, I don't know if people would remember who Abbie Hoffman is. But
they do. You say that in the book that people are not going to remember. Everybody remembers Abbie Hoffman.
Well, I don't know if they
Jerry
do.
Jerry Rubin, all those things.
I know, but, you know, it's a long time. But Abbie Hoffman.
I used to write him letters. Dear Abbie Hoffman, and ask him advice about Abbie Hoffman.
And he didn't reply.
No.
No. No, but I mean, but of all the other stories, starting with Bacall and Mary Martin and Zira Mostel and Robert Preston and Yul Brynner and all these you know, huge stars that I've had the luck to be in the same room with, and I would tell people these stories, and people would say, God, I hope you're writing this stuff down, because it's, you know, it's amazing, and I would sort of think, well, who would care, you know? And
really, you didn't even...
I didn't. I just thought, who am I? I'm some little young press agent, and, you know, I'm... Why would anybody care what I think? And it was only in the last couple of years that I thought, well, maybe I should write these stories. Some of these people are gone. Some of these people have, you know, are you know, and they were incredible stars. I mean, there are a lot of people that don't know who Mary Martin was. You know, Mary Martin was the biggest star on Broadway. She and Ethel Merman were the queens of Broadway.
And they haven't been captured enough on film. I mean,
no, they weren't.
A little bit, but not
Not very
enough.
Much. In fact, there's a new show coming out called Inventing Mary Martin, which actually I'm going to be working on, because the person that's putting it together knew of my great admiration and devotion to her as a fan, really, and thought, well, who could be better than Susan Shulman to be the press agent for a Mary Martin show? And so I am going to be working on it, which is lovely.
Mazel, yes.
Exactly, and I mean, I'm thrilled. It's going to be at the York Theater, and it's called Inventing Mary...
We're breaking
Mary
a story here. This
Inventing
is
Mary
Martin.
And nobody impersonates her, but they sing songs that she was associated with in all of her many shows, but it also includes her film and her television. It's kind of
Peter Pan, I guess.
Yes,
yeah, right,
but
yeah.
But I mean, she did a lot of TV specials. She did a mm-hmm. famous one with remember that Ford 50th anniversary show she did. Well, anyway, and she did a wonderful show with Noel Coward. I mean, she did a lot of television. And so it incorporates all of that. It's good. There are four, I think there's three women playing Mary Martin. And then
and one cross-dresser.
And actually Jason Graw is going to be sort of the compare.
I love Jason Graw.
I love Jason Graw, too. He's a client of mine, actually. And do you remember there was a show a couple of years ago, more than a couple of years ago, called Side by Side by Sondheim?
Sure.
And it's going to be of that kind of a review, except it's about Mary Martin. And Jason is kind of the host of the evening.
Oh, if it's got
doesn't
Jason
sound,
in it, we know it's going to be good.
Doesn't that sound fun?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes, it absolutely does.
I think so,
does.
Too. Yeah.
By the way, we're talking with Susan Linda Shulman.
Right.
What's your Hebrew name, by the way?
Sarah Zvei.
Sarah Zvei Shulman, right? This is your maiden. Have you ever been married?
Nope.
Just personally?
Nope.
But this is interesting to me because one thing that comes across in the book is that when you had a hunky actor, you were like, woo, woo, woo. You know,
well,
licking your chops,
yeah, well,
as it were.
I'm a girl, you know. I mean,
But did you devote your life to the theater instead of?
No.
Okay.
No.
Short answer to the question.
No.
Were there any special liaisons with the famous people?
There may have been, but we're not going to talk about it.
Okay, but that's what? What is that? Your next book?
No.
Your job is to promote. My job is to dig a little.
I understand.
Give a hint. Give initials.
Go for it.
Give initials. Yeah.
You know what? I wouldn't be a good press agent if I didn't know how to deal with this question.
Okay. Wait, if it's someone no longer living, we could.
And how about if they are living?
Well, if they don't mind, then you don't mind.
I mind.
Oh, because you like to keep that completely
Nothing. It's nothing to do with it.
Well, but everybody likes to read the.
I understand back. That.
Okay.
Tough, aren't I?
All right.
See,
Sherman Helmsley. No, not Sherman Helmsley.
Sherman Helmsley.
Mr. Jefferson, he got swagger.
I think the age might have been a little off there. I don't
All right, well, okay, yeah. If we're rolling back a little bit.
Arnold Stang. I think, again, the ages might have been
perhaps
off.
Perhaps a little
yeah,
off.
Yeah, maybe. Just
now, speaking of beloved, wonderful actors like Sherman Helmsley and Arnold Stang, one person who you might not, some people not put in that category, but you do, is George C. Scott.
Yes. Interestingly, George C. Scott, who, you know, people were very afraid of George C. Scott, and you know, he had kind of a very imposing look, and he, you know, he had very bold features, and he was quite a large, tall man, and he was very imposing. But my experience with George C. Scott was that he was just adorable. I just thought he was charming and nice and funny and easygoing and all the things that you don't think of when you think of George C. Scott. And Maureen Stapleton, who did Plaza Suite with him on Broadway, used to refer to him as the big pussycat. And I always thought, George C. Scott? But when I met him, I could see what she meant, because there was, he didn't care about the trappings of stardom, and he didn't care about, you know, his place in the world and his, you know, that he was a big star and that he was a movie star and that he was a Broadway star. He really didn't care. And the perfect example of this is, he was in a wonderful comedy by Larry Gelbart called Sly Fox.
Right, based on Volpone's.
Exactly,
right.
And he was wonderful in it. Hector Elizondo was in it, Gretchen Weiler was in it, George's wife, Trish Vandeveer, was in it, Jack Gilford was in it.
Oh,
it was
Jack
wonderful.
Gilford.
Jack was wonderful. Jack had the longest rolling laugh in that play, and none of us could quite figure out why it was so funny. It was just, he had this joke, and it wasn't even a joke, it was just a sort of situational setup. And it would get a big laugh, and then as the laugh was kind of coming down and dwindling, it would strike you funny again, and the laugh would build again, and he would just freeze, and he would just hold the moment, and everybody on stage would just hold the moment, and it was a rolling laugh. It would go ah, ha, 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 ha. And it would go on and on and on and on, and I would say to Jack, why is that so funny? I mean, I look at the line and it's not that funny. And he said, it's the moment, it's, you know, it's the way we're all playing the moment, and it would just go on and on. I've never ever seen a moment like that on stage. And I can't even tell you what the line was. It was a scene with Gretchen Weiler, and even if I could tell you, it wouldn't make sense.
But then if it's Jack Gilford, the line could have been the.
It could have been, and it probably was. But it was just hysterical. And it would go on and on and on and on. And then it would, just as it was kind of over, you know, somebody in the audience would, like, say it to themselves, and then and they would laugh, and it would start again. And this would go on sometimes for a couple of minutes.
Oh, my God.
And, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It was hysterical. And the interesting thing was, a couple of years ago, the show was revived with Richard Dreyfuss and some other
I remember I saw that one, yes.
And I remember thinking, I can't quite remember what that line is that Jack had in that scene, but I was kind of waiting for it, and it didn't happen. So it was Jack.
It was Jack.
It was Jack and Gretchen who made it so funny. It wasn't the line as much, although God knows Larry Gelbart's, you know, wonderful, wonderful writer. But it was the way it was done that was so funny. There was another actor in Sly Fox who had a walk-on. He had one crossover in the play, and he played a servant, and he had, I think, one line in the show. And every night he'd make this crossover from one wing to the other. And I would watch him, and he would always get a laugh. And I'd think, why is he getting a laugh? Why, you know, he wasn't doing like a funny walk or anything. He wasn't like tripping. He wasn't doing shtick. He would just walk across the stage, and it was funny. And it would get funnier and funnier and funnier as the run went on. And I used to think, what is he doing? I kept watching to see. That actor was Jeffrey Tambor.
Oh, my God.
And he,
Hey, now.
And he had this little bit part, which he did really, really well. And when Hector Elizondo left, and he was the co-star with George, Jeffrey took over that part, and that was kind of the beginning of his career.
Wow. But
wonderful. But anyway, back to George C. Scott.
Yes.
So George C. Scott had finished his engagement, his commitment to Sly Fox, and he was getting ready to leave. And he was going to be replaced by Robert Preston.
Wow.
Another one of my heroes. And I was in a meeting one day, and they said, we have a problem. I said, what's the problem? They said, well, we need to paint out George C. Scott's name on this big sign on the top of the theater so that we have enough time for it to dry so we can then paint in Robert Preston's name in Sly Fox. So the problem is, in order for it to be ready when Preston goes into the show, we have to paint out George C. Scott's name early. And so me, with the arrogance of youth in this meeting with the Schuberts and everybody, I say, he won't care about that. And they said, oh, really? And I said, no, he won't care about that. And they said, I said, I'll ask him. And they went, yes, Susan, that's good. You ask him. Because everybody was afraid of George C. Scott. So the next day I went to the theater and I said, he called me Little Susan and I called him Big George for reasons I can't remember. So I said, Big George, you know that tab sign on the top of the theater? He said, what tab sign? I said, trust me, there's a tab sign on the top of the theater with your name on it. I said, do you care if we have to paint your name out a few days before you leave the show so that Bob Preston's name can be up there? He says, I don't give a shit.
Wonderful.
He didn't care. It was no ego. It was nothing. And that stuff didn't matter to him. And it was so interesting because people were so afraid of him because he did have a temper and he had been known to go on,
He was on a bender, I imagine he could have been a different...
Well, I'm sure he was, but I never saw it. I mean, it was interesting because...
And you mentioned he threw a party for all the cast in his
home.
He did.
He and Trish were very private and you couldn't actually call them at home. You had to call a guest house or something, and then somebody would walk the message up to the house. It was all very convoluted. So you couldn't actually just pick up the phone and call them because they were very private. But Sly Fox was a very, very happy company, and they loved that company, and they were very happy to be in that show. And so George and Trish, who lived in Greenwich, I think, had this big baronial house, and they gave a party for the whole company, and they had a bus to bring us all up to the house, and
wow.
He played his majestic organ for us, and he was wonderful. And
that's literal, by the way, folks.
That's why I...
Yeah, well, no, they can't see your hands playing.
I know, but I'm moving them like an organ, right? A piano kind of gesture.
Right, okay.
But I mean, he was adorable, and I couldn't have been, you know, sweeter. The invitation to the party was issued in the name of their two gigantic mastiff dogs. I can't remember their names. When I was writing the book, I was trying desperately to remember the names of the dogs. But the invitation was, say, Spot and, you know, whatever, invite you to. And that was who you RSVP'd to, was to the dogs.
See, but as I said before, it's nice to hear good stories, especially about people that don't necessarily have their reputation.
No. And I mean, I was as nervous as anybody else about, you know, meeting Scott, because he did have a reputation for being this kind of larger-than-life person.
Okay. Yeah.
And I mean, I subsequently did three shows with him, and he was very fond of the folks at the Circle and Square, and he directed All God's Chillin' Got Wings, which was an O'Neill play that Trish was in. And then he directed himself in a production of Death of a Salesman.
Wow. Wow.
And he had, it was interesting, he hired a very, very fine character actor to be his stand-in. Not his understudy or his standby, but his stand-in. So that when he was directing a scene that he was in as Willie Loman, he would have this actor sometimes play the scene with the other actors, so George, the director, could step away and have a fuller
right.
vision of what the scene, how the scene was working. And I've never seen anybody else do that. It was very interesting, although not that many people direct and act.
But did the actor try to approximate George C. Scott's?
No, he didn't. And that was what was so extraordinary, was George wanted him to make the part his own, because he was an actor that he respected and was a well-respected character actor. He wasn't some nobody.
Right.
He was somebody.
Do you remember
that,
who that was?
I can't. And I, if we look on IBDB, we can figure it out. I want to say Roy Poole, but I'm not sure that's right. But it was somebody who had many Broadway credits. He was a distinguished actor. He wasn't some, you know, it wasn't.
Sherman Helmsley.
No.
Was not, okay.
No. No.
That will be the correct answer.
That was
at one point.
On something. On
yes.
Some, not in this particular case, but. But whoever he was, and he was a good actor, but he didn't impose his interpretation on him as Willie Loman. He let the actor play the scene as he would play it, which was very respectful and generous of him as an actor and as a director. It was extraordinary.
And did the production work? Was it a good...
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. It was wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're talking still with Susan Linda Schulman, what was it, Sarah Leve?
Sarah Svay.
Sarah Svay. What, so that means Sarah too? Were you like the
twin? It was daughter of, I think.
Well, that'd be Bat.
Well, that's what I was told. What
can I say? So Faye, sure.
Here's a question for you, Rabbi.
Oh, okay, yes.
I got a question. Okay, so my name was Susan. My father's name was Saul.
Yes.
And my grandmother's name was Sarah.
What, your grandmother's name, yeah, right?
How is that possible, that I was named Susan? Isn't that against the rules?
Meaning they were alive when you
yes.
still they didn't take
when
the letter
I was
after
named.
The
no. They were all alive.
Maybe.
Isn't that interesting?
Were they done with a shin instead of a sin?
I don't know.
This is a puzzler.
Isn't
I'll
it?
Have to ask God.
I've always wondered about that, because my father was Orthodox as a child. I mean, he came from an Orthodox home, and so I always wondered how that happened.
Well, it's also a tradition thing rather than a Talmudic. It's like,
but I thought it was the initial, that you weren't allowed to name somebody with the same initial
if they're still living. But again, that could be just tradition rather than, like, you know.
I don't know.
Rambam says you should not do this.
I don't know. I always wondered about that, because.
That's a good question.
Yeah. Anyway.
A couple more quickie questions for the delightful Susan L. Schulman.
Yes.
Speaking of stars a little bit more, some stars are always sort of on and have the wattage, and like you go, oh, a star, and you met Cary Grant and Newman and Robert Redford.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it about Robert Redford?
I thought I was pretty cool until I got to work with Robert Redford. I thought, well, I've been around stars, I've worked with some, I mean, I've met Frank Sinatra, I've met Paul Newman, that's pretty good. But Redford was overwhelming to me, and I handled a benefit with him, and I got the full wattage directed directly at me. He was smart, and he was funny, and he remembered my name, and he looked right in the eye, and he listened to you, and he responded to what you said. And of course, he was gorgeous. And he was smart. You know, it was everything. It was the full deal. And I worked with him for this benefit, and worked quite closely with him. And he was very helpful and cooperative. We were promoting an organization that his wife had begun.
By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you can tell this conversation is taking place in New York.
Yes.
Because there's like Armageddon going on outside. You're probably hearing this in the background.
We are in Times Square, and
yes.
I am on the 16th floor, and it is still, you can hear every siren that goes by.
Forgive me.
That's
please
all right.
Continue.
That's all right. You're setting the stage. So anyway, I handled a benefit that Redford was involved with. His wife at the time, Lola Redford, had created an organization called Consumer Action Now with Carlin Glenn, the artist that was in Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And Consumer Action Now are the people that created Earth Day, which still is an ongoing celebration every year, that conservation and all that. Anyway, so Redford sort of lent his star wattage to this benefit. And it was star wattage. It was pretty dazzling. And at the end of the press part of the cocktail party, which was all I was involved with, Carlin asked me if I'd like to stay for dinner. And I said, no, thank you, but I couldn't. And I went home. And the next day, Carlin said to me, why didn't you stay for dinner? And I said, I have never been so overwhelmed with anybody the way I was with Redford. I just felt like I was hanging on by my toenails and that I was very close to making a complete jerk of myself. And that I decided it was better to just go home than to turn into a blubbering idiot in front of this perfectly lovely man.
The other thing that you said about him is that he could turn it off and on.
Yes.
He would be in a photo shoot.
I'd heard stories about people that could do that, could turn the wattage up and down and either be noticed or not noticed. And I'd read once that Spencer Tracy could walk down the street and he sort of turn it up a notch and everyone would go, oh my God, there's Spencer Tracy, and then he would turn it down a notch somehow and nobody would notice him. And at this event, I was standing next to Robert Redford and setting up photos, and then at some point we would look at each other and we'd realize that maybe it was time for a break and we'd take a break. And then maybe 10 or 15 minutes later, I decided it was time to set up some more photos. And I look around and I realize that he'd been standing 5 feet from me. And I hadn't noticed. And I had never seen anybody do that before. Because one minute he was this absolutely dazzling personality that you couldn't take your eyes off. And somehow he could turn it down and you didn't notice he was there. And I just couldn't get over that.
Wow.
It was pretty impressive.
I have that sometimes.
Do you see? Yes.
I was standing right by you 10 minutes, you didn't even see me.
And I didn't see. See? It's
now I am larger than life.
It's amazing skill to have.
Shadow on the wall, ladies and gentlemen.
It's amazing.
Now, speaking of larger than life, now we have mentioned some extraordinarily huge and important people. Mm-hmm. Eddie Cantor, Arnold Stang, and of course, Sherman Hemsley. But one of the biggest of all,
the answer to the quiz.
That's right. Except it's not the answer to this one. This is one of the biggest, most important, back in the day when the producer's name went above the, it almost was the title.
That's right.
Back in the day. The man, was David Merrick.
That's right.
Who you did get to work with.
I did.
Not on Hello, Dolly. This would have been...
A little later than that, yes.
Subway's Up for Sleeping later than that.
A little later than that, yes.
This was on a show... Was it the... Not Crazy... what was it? It was... State Fair, the musical with John Davidson. Mm-hmm. Another of the quiz answers, by the way. Keep that name in.
Oh, lovely man.
John Davidson. Yes. You would have a cute story about him.
And
he
pigs.
Wanted a live pig in the show.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And?
Well, State Fair is a story about pig farmers in Iowa. And so before the show got into rehearsal, John Davidson had the idea that we should have a live pig in the show. And Jamie Hammerstein, who was one of the co-directors, who is Oscar Hammerstein's son, kept saying, John, we don't want a live pig in the show. Trust me, you don't want a live animal in a play, in a musical. And John kept saying, oh, it'll be great, we'll have a live pig. So before the show began, we decided we needed to take pictures of John with pigs. So John and I went out to the World Pork Expo in Iowa, in Des Moines, where, let me tell you, there are very few Jews in Des Moines.
No.
And there are none at the World Pork Festival. And so we took lots of pictures.
Well, they're coming after sundown in a bus.
That's right, yes. There's no Jews there. And so we took lots of pictures of John with lots of pigs, and we had a high old time with the pigs. And then we decided to shoot a TV commercial. And in the TV commercial, the concept was that John was going to sing to a little piglet. He was going to sing, our state fair is a great state fair. Okay, so we rented piglets from a pig farmer. Now, pigs in Iowa are not raised to be pets. They're raised for slaughter. This is what pig farmers do.
Okay.
But we have this perfectly adorable actor singing away at this pig who doesn't know what the hell has happened and is not terribly pleased. And so the pig screams through the entire commercial. So the pig not only screams, but he pees on John, he throws up on John. The pig is not happy. So we had rented three piglets to shoot this commercial because we didn't know. Maybe we'd get, you know, one that wasn't such a professional. We didn't know. So poor John. So every time John would sing to the stupid little pigs, the pigs would scream and pee on John. And then we would have to stop. So, but what we discovered
Please tell me there's existing B-roll on...
But there's a photo on my wall of John singing to the pig and me sitting at the piano pretending to play, and that picture is actually in the book.
Oh, my God.
And that is... It's not a very good picture, but it's actually in the book. But anyway, so what we discovered, though, was that these pigs are not used to being touched by people. They're touched three times. They're touched when they're born, they're touched when they're branded or something, and then they're touched when they're slaughtered. So the fact that this man with dimples was singing away at them, they didn't know what the hell was going on. So every time we'd have to stop because the take would be ruined because the pig was screaming and throwing up on John, who was a very good sport through all this, there was a little girl who came with the pigs. She was like taking care of the piglets. And every time we would have this ruined take with the screaming pig, the little girl would walk over to the pig, pick it up by one of its hind legs, and walk around with the pig dangling from her hands, and the pig would immediately go to sleep.
Oh.
Now, we don't know why this is, because what do we know? We're city folk. But it was hysterical, because first the pig is having a fit with John singing to it, and then it instantly would fall back to sleep, because the little girl was carrying it around by its hind leg. So then we would start with pig number two. Piglet number two would get sung to, and then piglet number two would scream and throw up and pee on John. And then we would go to piglet number three, and then she would pick up that one and walk around with it. Well, it was so funny. In the middle of one of these endlessly ruined takes, somebody off camera very innocently said, and I was sitting at the piano pretending to play because I don't play piano in the commercial, just because they needed a body. And off camera during one of the breaks, somebody very innocently said, "So John, is there going to be a live pig in the show?" And within unison, both of our heads swiveled around to the person and went, "No." And John never mentioned having a live pig again.
And what's beautiful is that in the actual show, he picks up and cradles Sherman Helmsley in his arms and sings to him.
There you go. It's amazing. Sherman Helmsley.
Now, the producer of Stage Fair was
David Merrick.
The great, the abominable showman.
The abominable showman, yes. And David Merrick was this legendary producer who I'd grown up on David Merrick shows. And so when David Merrick kind of bought his way into State Fair, he wasn't one of the initial, initially it was produced by the Theater Guild. And then David Merrick invested in the show when we were on tour prior to Broadway. And then it became David Merrick Presents, the Theater Guild production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's State Fair. Big mouthful. Okay. So... But at the time, sadly, David Merrick had a stroke, a major stroke, and so he could neither walk nor talk. So while David Merrick was, in fact, the producer of the show, he wasn't a big participant in the production because he couldn't speak.
He was like an investor more than a...
Well, except that he had a partner, his companion, and she would interpret. So you would ask him a question, and he would mumble something, and then she would interpret it. And you'd think, well, how did she get all that from that, you know, groan or whatever? And it was extraordinary because she was, for all practical purposes, speaking for David Merrick. And so...
I imagine if she said something untoward, he would shake his head, and then she would change.
Sometimes. Right. Sometimes. So. But sometimes not. You know, sometimes he was very engaged and other times he wasn't. So it was, but she was calling the shots because she was interpreting for David Merrick. And so it was a very odd situation and very fraught because while you kind of wished it was David Merrick in his full powers, there were also obviously many stories about David Merrick being, you know, very difficult and a taskmaster and, you know, being various things that we
so
all
know.
So
did that give the creators more creative freedom because they knew they had a little more...
No, not really. I mean, a little bit because what they were trying to do, the Theatre Guild folks who were now kind of in bed with David Merrick, so to speak, they tried to recreate sort of Merrick's heyday where Merrick would kind of tweak the press and he would always try to find an angle where they would he could sort of stick it to the press.
And the Subways Are for Sleeping.
Exactly. The famous Subways Are for Sleeping campaign, which was Merrick, had gotten mediocre to lousy reviews for this musical that Phyllis Newman was in, and I actually saw. And he found people with the exact same names as the major theater critics in New York, and he wined them and dined them, and then he got them all to issue quotes, and then he took out a full page ad and the time, I think it was the Herald Tribune, where he quoted all of these people who had the same names but were in fact not the real critics. And
it was brilliant,
and it was clever and it was smart. And not only did he get the bang of that ad, But then he got the bang of all the fallout from the ad.
Because 3 weeks of controversy.
Because at some point the newspaper realized they'd been had, and so they wrote about the fact that they'd been had. And then other people wrote about the fact. And so he got, it was like that rolling laugh,
yes,
where it just went on and on and on. And so Merrick, I mean, it was very clever. It was brilliant. And it's still talked about today as one of the great stunts.
But what did they do for State Fair? I mean, there's a picture of the guy in the big Uncle Sam top hat.
Right.
Times okay. It's,
yeah, that's okay. Yeah. No, that wasn't it. What we did was there was a series of ads that ran, which unfortunately I don't have anymore, but there was a series of ads that were done around the time of the Tony Awards. And it was using a photo of Merrick when he was in his heyday with his kind of, you know, hat, the hat at the angle, and the gold tipped cane, and his, you know, his kind of famous look. And they were, it was called something like Memos from Merrick. And they were all these kind of snarky, funny, clever ads commenting on what was going on Broadway. And it was commenting on other shows, it was comparing things. And it was at the time of the Tony Award nominations when the Theatre Guild and supposedly Merrick were pissed off because State Fair was not nominated for Best Score. And the reason given was because a lot of the score was written for the film and not for stage, except that there were other examples of scores that had been written for film and then transferred to Broadway that had been nominated.
Right.
And so it was a very controversial thing, and in fact Merrick sued the league, which was a publicity stunt, but I mean I was in the middle of it because I was the press agent, and so it was all connected with that, and the ads actually were very clever. The truth of the matter was that I don't know that Merrick ever saw the ads. I mean they were created by the Theatre Guild and the advertising agency, and whether he even approved them I never knew. I sort of doubt it actually. But people were talking about them because they thought, oh, Merrick's up to his old tricks. And that was the goal.
But, so there, you were generating this press, this was all going on, but the people just did not come to State Fair. It just didn't...
Well, it was, don't forget, State Fair opened at the same time as Rent. And that was the big show.
Right.
And State Fair actually was never intended to come to Broadway. It was originally it was a film. It was the only Rodgers and Hammerstein score that was written for film, and it stayed that way. And then in the mid '90s, someone at the North Carolina School of the Arts decided to create a stage musical, and they commissioned somebody that actually worked for the R&H organization to write it, and they interpolated a couple of songs from other R&H shows. And it was done at North Carolina School of the Arts, and that was essentially the production that the Theatre Guild sort of bought, not the same cast, but basically bought that, and decided to do a national tour. And it was never supposed to come to New York, and it was created to really be another string in the Rodgers and Hammerstein's catalog.
The things that could go to high school.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. And so they had the Big Five, you know, King and I and Sound of Music and South Pacific and all those. And then there were other shows, other R&H properties. And this was intended to be another one of those properties that could be done, as you say, in community theater and in schools. And it was that kind of a show. It was very, I used to say it's like theatrical comfort food. You went in knowing the score. You went in. It was a very warm, affectionate show, and I used to say, people, you would about 10 minutes into the show, I would look at the audience, and everybody would be sitting there with a big dopey grin on their face.
Yeah, I'm not saying this was a bad show.
No, it wasn't.
It was nice.
It was a charming show. I thought. I mean, I really loved State Fair, but I mean, everybody in it was charming. There was a warmth about it that was very satisfying for people, and it was done in a kind of old-fashioned way. But it was never intended to come to Broadway. And it was only when Merrick came into the picture with his money and everything else that suddenly it went from being a 9-month tour, national
right.
tour, to being a pre-Broadway tour. And it all happened quite quickly, too. I mean, it suddenly was going to be on Broadway. And it was never intended to be on Broadway. And so it was very interesting because we kind of felt that it could have a place. It had done very well on the tour. It had gotten mostly rave reviews, and people loved it. I mean, it was a very endearing show, and it still is. I mean, I think there's a place for shows like that. But
Well, there is. I mean, if you look at right now, Cinderella.
Exactly.
Is doing
exactly.
Well.
And Cinderella's a wonderful production. It's so imaginative, and they've updated it in a very clever, you know, kind of. It's just really well done.
So there's room. You know, there's room for Book of Mormon.
And absolutely. Yeah. But Rent was this. You know, was supposedly this revolutionary, edgy, new musical. I mean, in fact, I think Rent is kind of a conventional musical in terms of the structure and the storyline. It's, you know, it's La Boheme, but it's but at the time it was considered to be very edgy and, you know, hip and young and cool and everything. And then there was this, you know, kind of comfort food show with Rodgers and Hammerstein, which was kind of old-fashioned and sweet and family-oriented in it, and it just couldn't find its place. And it didn't have, you know, like mega stars. It had people that everybody grew up on, John Davidson and Catherine Crosby, Bing Crosby's wife, and it had a lot of really good Broadway people like Donna McKechnie and Scott Wise, and you know, people that Andre McArdle, you know, really good people.
Yeah.
But they weren't mega stars. And so I think it was just, I think some of it was timing. I think it wasn't a blockbuster kind of show. It wasn't intended to be. But it was never intended to be on Broadway. That was the irony of it all. And it was because Merrick came in and wanted it to go on, you know, wanted to move, because he wanted to remind people that he was still a power.
One last time.
Yeah.
I think he had one other show after that, a black version of musical. Not the guys in Dolls.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah, I don't know if that was before or after, but yes.
I'm not sure,
but it was around the same time.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was kind of... all things came together, and so it did come to Broadway. But, you know, maybe it should have, maybe it shouldn't have, who knows, but it did.
Now, we're closing our wonderful conversation with Susan Linda Shulman.
And Backstage Pass to Broadway.
True Tales from a Theater Press Agent, available at all the usual places, from Heliotrope Books, by the way. I'm kind of curious, these names that you're the people that you've worked with, you're not an old woman.
No, I'm not, and I'm still doing it.
Right.
Yep.
But I'm wondering, I mean, was there a point when, because now in the past few years you have not necessarily represented a lot of the major shows.
No.
Was that a personal decision? Did you step away and let go of Ryan Brown and
no.
Dartmouth? So, no. So what happens? Why?
What happens? Sometimes,
yeah.
Sometimes it's somebody's time. And, you know, there's always been one or two big press agents at any given time. And when I was first coming up, I worked for some of them. I worked for Merle Dubusky, who was the king of Broadway for quite a long time.
I have to say, that is one of my personal villains.
Is he?
This
oh,
is
I'm
someone
sorry to hear
I do
that.
Not like.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Well,
I mean, maybe you had a different experience with him, but something about that office.
Yeah.
And I know he's still alive.
Yes.
But
no.
I can say
okay.
that he was always a bastard to me.
Nothing to do with me. Okay. But anyway.
Or not so much to me, but to my good friend Dave.
Okay. To Dave, right. But, you know, I worked for some of the kind of legendary press. I worked for Bill Dahl. It was my first job. And so, you know, there's always been one or two offices that were the big offices. And I think more and more it became very difficult for smaller offices like mine to compete with the bigger offices, because people think, and it's not necessarily the truth, but they think that if they hire the press agent that has whatever the big show is at that moment, whether it's the producers or whatever, that somehow it will magically rub off on their show, and that somehow that magic will be contagious. And unfortunately, that's not how it works. You know, we don't trade off like that. And so I think it's difficult for sole proprietors like myself that have small offices and, you know, small
staffs.
Well,
were you ever tempted, or were you ever asked to join one of the, and you demurred?
Well, I began working with bigger offices, and I never wanted to, and I also had another career where I was in television for 6 years, where I ran big departments, where I ran departments of 20, 30, 40 people. And so I had had that experience of supervising a great, you know, staff and all, and didn't particularly like it. I much prefer doing it than supervising other people doing it. I mean, I remember when I was at USA Network, I was sending a press associate off to Paris for a month to be the press rep on a show, and I remember thinking, not only is that more fun than what I'm doing, but I would be better at it than them. And, you know, instead I'm here doing fourth quarter marketing reviews. Not so much fun.
Middle management.
Not so much fun. And so it was a very conscious decision that I never wanted to have an empire, and I never wanted to run a big shop, that I was very hands-on, and that what made me valuable to a client, whether it was a show or an individual actor, was to know that if they hired me, they got me. They didn't get an associate. and that has been consistent. Because
so are you a, I mean, you're off, we're happily here in your office. There's
yes.
a couple of different rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You have a
I have an associate.
An intern or an associate.
I have an associate. Yes, who's not here right now, but I have an associate. And, you know, I take on as much or as little as I want. Luckily, I'm in a position to do that.
Thank God.
And yes. thank God, exactly. And,
so may
and
I ask,
so, you know,
who are your current, you mentioned the show that's coming to New York. What are
well,
your
I work with some individual actors. I work with people like Kathleen Chalfant, the wonderful actress in Angels in America. Like Jason Grah, I work with people like Karen Ziemba.
Oh.
So, you know, lots of really wonderful actors. And then I have another project that I can't talk about quite yet because we haven't announced it yet. I do lots
the Eddie Cantor story.
There you go. We're starring Sherman Helmsley.
That's right.
Or whatever his name is. And Eddie Cantor.
And Arnold Stang, amazing.
And Arnold, it's amazing that cast. And so I have lots of projects. And, you know, they're not the blockbusters. But that's okay. You know,
that's
okay.
Right. If you're making a living,
that's right.
That's what it's all
it's
about.
Fine.
If you're paying the rent
that's
on
right.
an office right
that's
in town.
That's right. I'm in Times Square.
It's
in the
famous.
Paramount Building, which is a very famous landmark building in New York.
What was your greatest, this is our final, and thank you
okay.
for spending all this
no,
time with
right.
us. I hope I'm, I know. But your favorite moment of all time involved in the theater? Besides this one right now.
Well, aside from that, but. Well, I think the fact that I once got the chance to repay Mary Martin for her kindness to me as a kid. I was once at a live radio broadcast that she did with Anthony Quayle at the Kennedy Center. I'll tell this very quickly. And somebody got up and said something that was kind of insulting to her. And I couldn't stand it. I mean, it was like, this was a live radio broadcast that was heard nationally. And as far as I was concerned, you can't insult Mary Martin in front of me. And so the next time they took questions from the audience, I was able to get up and on this live broadcast say something that smoothed it over. And afterwards I thought, how lucky am I? I mean, how often do you get to actually pay back somebody that was so generous and kind to you as a kid and famous and important and all those things that was kind of your idol? And how lucky was I that I actually had this opportunity to thank her and publicly pay her back and actually sort of save her from an embarrassing situation. And I always thought, I'm the luckiest girl alive.
Well, I feel like the luckiest girl alive, ladies and gentlemen, to be able to talk and to offer my genuine thanks for the time and the stories of Susan Linda Shulman in her book, Backstage Pass to Broadway, True Tales from a Theater Press Agent. Did you save some in reserve for a sequel?
You never know.
You never know. You'll have to keep checking our website, backstagepasstobroadway.com. Susan Shulman, bless you. Thank you so much for being in the neighborhood.
Thank you, Rabbi.